No news from Sky. It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping us review this week's news is Green Councillor for Bishopston and Ashley Down, Eleanor Cumley. After the 6 o'clock news, last week we looked at the century since the Balfour Declaration and the 50 years since Israel's Six-Day War, where they grabbed what's still known today as the occupied territories. Tonight, on a theme of political manipulation, we look at another centenary. It's 300 years ago tomorrow, the first Grand Lodge of English Freemasons was formed, though Masons themselves deny it. What's the evidence there? Part of a mystery religion which targets businesses, the armed forces, politics and faith, going back thousands of years. Also Israel and 9/11 from the former head of the US Army War College, no less. And is the war on terror actually meant to be won or to go on forever? Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 and some light rain this weekend, highs of 21 Celsius. A mainly cloudy weekend with a few showers and a few sunny spells. Next week, highs again around 21, sunny spells and some showers. Next weekend, that's the 1st and 2nd of July, highs of 18, sunshine and heavy showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Green Councillor for Bishopston and Ashley Down, Eleanor Cumley. Now, did I pronounce that right, Eleanor?
It's Cumley.
Cumley.
The B is...
With a B.
In there, yeah.
Okay, you've been a councillor for just over a year now. Can you tell us what got you into politics?
Well, mainly I just got tired of shouting at my radio and I felt I needed to actually get up and do something rather than just get frustrated. It was really the Labour Party's failure to stand up against austerity that pushed me into looking for an alternative place to find a political home.
But it must be a bit frustrating because as a councillor you're having to implement austerity.
Well, I'm in the fortunate position that I'm not in the majority in the council house and I can stand up and still say that this is not acceptable, this is not economically needful and this is not something that our society in Bristol can withstand.
So do you think we should just keep going on borrowing forever?
I think that we have injected huge amounts of money into the economy, but it's been injected through the banks, and that's where it stayed. I think there is definitely scope for using that money generation to invest in infrastructure, invest in renewable energy, actually do things that would make our lives better, rather than just have it disappear somewhere into the banking system.
Okay, what's your background, your education? What sort of things have you done before you got into politics?
So I studied physics and then became a physics teacher. I went to Ethiopia where I worked in a teacher training college for a couple of years. And when I came back to the UK, I trained as a computer programmer. And that was a great job to do when the kids were young because it's flexible. I was working from home. It's remarkably well paid for the amount of responsibility you have to take because it's a skill that not many people have. So I did that until my children got a bit older and I started thinking I wanted to get out and do something a bit more sociable and a bit more that I could see the value in. And that was when I got engaged in politics.
What about computer programming? It covers a whole multitude of stuff. Did you ever feel that you were doing anything which was not ethical? Because a lot of this sort of automation is just putting people out of work. And also, of course, there's a lot of work. In fact, I was chatting recently to some graduates, Bristol University graduates, saying almost all the work is in the military.
Well, I worked for a firm which produced software for solicitors, and we did lots of the legal aid forms so that they were easier to fill in and they could claim their support for legal aid. So you could argue about whether that's an entirely ethical place to work, but I think it certainly did more good than harm.
Okay, so what are your responsibilities on the City Council here? What committees are you on, that sort of thing?
So the main committee I've been sitting on is the People Directorate Scrutiny. So that is the committee which oversees education, health, adult social care and children's social care. I'm also very actively involved in the corporate parenting panel. And I have since March, I've been the leader of the Green Group, which, because the Greens are not a very hierarchical organisation, is not quite the same as being a leader in one of the other groups.
Do they do what they're told?
Absolutely not, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
You talk about, was it corporate parenting there?
Yes.
What on earth is that?
Oh, sorry, yeah, that's a jargon for you. Basically, the corporate parenting panel checks that the council is meeting its duties to children in care.
And is it?
It's getting a lot better, and I think there's a real will to do the best we can and to keep improving. So I've been quite impressed with the people that I've seen in that area and the work that they're doing.
Well, now, the council officers, I'm sure, love new councillors like you because it's easier to pull the wool over your eyes. They have been doing this for a long, long time, and they can just give you reports, and they're hoping that you're not going to really be able to scrutinise what they're up to. Do you ever feel like you're pushing against a kind of big edifice of the civil service with the council officers?
I think there's a long history of a culture in which the officers are the experts. The councillors throw their weight around but don't really know in which direction to throw it. And everybody feels comfortable with that because that's the way they've been doing it. As a Green, part of my responsibility is to challenge things that are being done in the way that they've always been done.
Okay, so what have you been challenging? Tell us something, anyway.
So one of the things that we've been looking at is the way that reports are presented, the way that scrutiny is done, the way that communication between officers and councillors works. It's not very glamorous, and it's not going to change overnight. I can't point at any big wins that I've had in a year, because I think cultures take a long time to change. But I think we need to keep standing up, keep asking the questions, and keep encouraging good practice when we see it. In the corporate parenting panel, we receive reports that are written to communicate. They're not written in some kind of report writing style because that's the way we've always done it. They're written to make it clear what has actually happened. And we do have some quite frank and open discussions about what's been going wrong and what we could be doing better.
Yeah, because the officers love to give you a great chunk of paper, don't they? Like 100 pages or something to read. Do they actually manage to do decent summaries? Because that's one of the most important things. So you can read through 2 or 3 page summary and then actually you can then see, is this officer really teasing out what's most important about these pages that they're supposed to be working on full-time, whereas I'm really only a part-timer coming here checking up on them?
Yeah, I think it's really important that we do get reports that communicate clearly. Sometimes you do get hundreds of pages. And as you say, councillors are part-timers. They're paid to do the job part-time. There's no way they're going to read a 300-page report or 5 different 300-page reports for one meeting. So that ability to present the information in a way that we can understand it and to present the information that we ask for rather than answer the questions that you want to answer, I think that's something that we need to keep pushing on.
Well, look, you had big hopes, didn't you, for Bristol West this year? What with the general election just a couple of weeks ago, actually pretty much daunted and thwarted. After all that effort, you find that actually the Labour candidate Thangam Debonairs massively increased her majority, the biggest majority in the country.
Yes, it was absolutely astonishing to be part of watching that happen. We were having conversations with people and they were saying, love the Greens, support all your principles, would really love to have a Green MP, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to vote for Labour. It was really bizarre to hear people saying that, because you think, well, you know, you're a grown-up. You're actually allowed to vote for whoever you like. But people really felt that what they did in Bristol West was somehow magically going to influence what happened in the rest of the country, and that if they didn't vote Labour in Bristol West, somehow that would stop marginals elsewhere in the country going to Labour. It was the strangest. I mean, I've not been a politician very long. I've not been engaged in many campaigns, but it was certainly the strangest one I've ever been involved in.
Old Labour Oxford economist Marcy Summers, what do you make of the, fallout, from this recent general election? Because we're getting lots and lots of questions about legitimacy of the present government, and Theresa May seems to have decided, right, well, I'm just going to press on regardless.
Well, we were just discussing that before we came on air, in fact. I think the Greens were obviously going to have a difficult uphill struggle in Bristol West because of the Corbyn effect. And, of course, paradoxically enough, Thangam was one of the critics of Corbyn, but she's actually benefited enormously from his influence, and the same with Kerry and Karen. But I think that the Green Party isn't going to go away, and the Labour Party ultimately is going to have to forge alliances, I think. So, say, for example, the government falls and there's a snap election, it's unlikely that Labour will be able to form a government without having to negotiate with somebody. And they ought to be thinking about what that implies.
Anyway, Eleanor, do you have a vision for the city? Do the Greens have a vision for Bristol?
Yes, I think we would like to see a city that is run primarily for the benefit of its citizens, where we take some brave decisions about what we allow, and we look at the evidence of what really benefits people. So, for example, people love their cars. They love driving their cars through the centre of the city. But the evidence is that that is killing people with air pollution, that is causing ill health, it's causing social disintegration because people are sitting in their cars instead of talking to each other on their buses or walking through their neighbourhoods. And we need to look at that addiction to the private car and actually develop alternatives. And that in my mind, would include a living heart for the city, an area where you exclude cars from the very centre, and you have a place that is pleasant for people to live and work and shop and isn't just a through route.
I mean, isn't the problem much bigger with cars? It's that they're cheaper. Not everyone particularly wants to use a car, say if they're doing a long distance journey. But, it's just so much cheaper than, say, using the train. We don't have proper public transport in that we've got this private bus service, First Bus, that have just, I think, the Day Rover prices have just gone up again to about £5 or something. I mean, they're just milking us, effectively, and there's no tram. We've got this kind of half-hearted metro bus, the guided bus thing, which is not, you know, really is surely people are quite sensible to get cars, because we're left with that as the cheapest option.
It's never enough to say you have to not do this thing. We have to offer people genuine alternatives. We have to have cycle routes that are safe, that people feel they can take their children on, and people who are not experienced cyclists can use and feel comfortable and safe using.
But you can't use a bike in the winter. Bike in the winter is a bit of a nightmare, isn't it?
I do, but that's, and I'm not a hardcore cyclist. I only started cycling because it was the only sensible way to get my son to nursery. It's because there was no parking anywhere near it. I'm not sort of a cycling maniac, but it is a practical way of getting around Bristol. But also, you're absolutely right, public transport is key. If you look at the cities that have succeeded in tackling their congestion problems, the way they've done it is they've had huge investment in public transport. The speed that cars take to make a journey depends more closely on how quickly you can do the same journey by public transport than they do by anything else, because if there's a decent public transport alternative, people will switch to it. People aren't daft. If they've got a public transport alternative that is affordable that is pleasant to use, that is regular and reliable and runs late enough into the evening that they can get home again, then of course they're going to use it.
So with Metrobus, is it the delays that it's been causing while they've been building it the last couple of years on one side of the scales, and the advantage it's going to be once it's built on the other side of the scale, which one is the higher and which one is the lower?
With Metrobus, I feel a little bit like the old joke is that I wouldn't start from here if I wanted to get there. The decision to go ahead with Metrobus was made a long time ago. And now that we've made that decision, the thing's been built, I really want it to be a success. I really want people on the edge of the city to have a viable public transport alternative that gets past the congestion and means that they can be reliable and people can employ them because they know they can actually get to work on time. I want people to feel they can switch and they have an alternative to using their car, so that a lot of these new developments that are happening on the outskirts of the city don't funnel more and more cars through the centre and through the streets that my kids walk to school on.
One of the latest announcements about Metro Bus is that First Bus Bristol has been named as one of the first Metro Bus operators. I don't know how these people make these idiotic decisions, and I say idiotic because First Group were the people behind the Croydon tram crash, where this is a couple of years ago, where drivers had been flagging up to their bosses saying it's a really dangerous section of track, and what it seemed was happening was that they were kind of not being able to concentrate and they were coming out of a tunnel much too fast, and there were several close shaves, but First Group didn't do anything about it. And yet it seems that they're okay to run our Metro Bus, these people who were involved in causing this crash. There were several fatalities in Croydon a couple of years ago on a tram network. So, I mean, I would have thought they should be out of the running for operating our Metro Bus.
Yeah, I don't think we have a system in which any problem anywhere in a company bans that company from being employed to do anything anywhere else ever again. I mean, whether we should or not, it's an open question, but that's not the way.
I mean, for example, with this tower block fire, you would think that the people who did the refurbishment last year, there would be questions about whether they would be the right people anyway. Martin, well, it's interesting the influence that First Group seems to have, a massive influence in getting these contracts in the first place.
Well, I mean, the real problem goes back to the 1980s and the privatisation of the bus system all over Britain. And we've got used to what is basically a third-rate setup. I mean, if you go to foreign countries, they just laugh at the way we try and run things. In Seattle, I understand, all buses are free. People just hop on and hop off. That's the future. That's the Silicon Valley future.
I suppose we should really be grilling old Mark Bradshaw about this, about why he thinks First Group are okay to operate these trams. Not really a tram, is it? It's a sort of bus with
Well, they've got a monopoly. They're in a monopoly buying situation. I mean, if you're going to have to give it to somebody, they're in a position to make the bid, aren't they?
Well, First Group are servicing a massive debt in the
yes,
United
that's
States.
Right.
And so most of the money we pay to go on our public transport here just goes straight in interest payments. They nearly went bust. I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago completely, and they had to go completely refinance all of their debts and only just about managed to survive it. And now they'll be running our Metro.
Well, it used to be the Bristol Bus Company used to be run by Bristol City Council back in the 1950s, and it was very effective, and we just forgot about all of that.
I was lucky enough to grow up in Sheffield, where the bus service was absolutely fantastic. It was a publicly run bus service. When I was a child, 2p would take you anywhere in South Yorkshire, and people really valued that service. We were allowed to cross-subsidise routes, so the profitable routes meant that we could run services on the routes that really provided social value. Now we've got a situation where the bus companies take profit on the routes that are profitable, and the council subsidises them to run the others. It's just absolutely, nonsense.
It's bonkers, isn't it? Absolutely bonkers. Why do they do this? Well, it's a racket, effectively. Anyway, look, we mentioned, or I did anyway, the Grenfell Tower fire there a minute ago. And I recall back on this programme in 2009, we did a couple of shows looking at housing in the city. And one of the things we came across was proposals by the Lib Dems, a councillor called Mike Popham and another one called Cheryl Ann, to bring council housing stock in Bristol under these things called TMOs, now very notorious for the mismanagement of the Kensington and Chelsea estate, which Grenfell Tower was part of. These TMOs are misnamed, really, because even though it's called a tenant management organisation, only about a third of the people on the board are tenants. So it's not really run by tenants. It's run by non-executive directors and other appointees, like, for example, councillors. Some of the people on these boards are councillors. But the main problem at the time, as I remember it, was in Bristol, they were saying, well, there's just not enough expertise around the table to run housing. And also, it's at arm's length from the council. The council have built the houses. They're taking the rent. And yet there's this other group of people who aren't really accountable to anybody at arm's length, who will be managing the properties, and they didn't like it. So here in Bristol, Tom Cook takes up the story of what happened back in 2009 here in Bristol.
We had an area housing committee, and that was used as a base to set up this particular TMO. There was one person who was on the area housing committee who had been on for a number of years, but in a sort of technicality, he hadn't been actually elected. And so by one vote, the Area Housing Committee voted for a TMO with a group of people. And it was on a dice, there was roughly 3,000 dwellings. So they went through a process. There was also the one at Barton Hill. I don't know exactly the names of them. And, of course, some money went missing and somebody got jailed in that area, right? The one in our area was not accepted because of not being competent to be able to set up a TMO. And the one in
Barton Hill?
Barton Hill went. Mm-hmm. Hawfield didn't go. There was the Bedminster fell apart. And then there was the other by the roundabout up the top of Old Market in that area.
St Jude's area.
Yeah, probably, St Jude's yeah. area, okay. yeah. Anyway, so they went for a vote. And, you know, and people were involved. And, of course, there's a Somalian community as well.
So this is involving every... It's not just the board that's managing the area. It's the all the tenants voting.
Yeah, in that area. Of that area, the tenants was voting a few hundred. About around 1,000. Anyway, mainly the Somali people actually voted against it. I went to a meeting and a couple of us from the, you know, working on the council and myself went to a meeting of those people, of about 30-odd people there. And they over... there was a month of voting, but at the end of the day, when the voting took place, there were, compared with many other areas where TMOs had been set up on the basis of 10% voting or 16% voting in the country, right, in this area it was near enough over 50% of people, and they voted against that TMO, so TMOs fell apart. But they were never initiated, to me, by tenants themselves. They were manipulated from a political directive, I think, you know.
Well, three cheers for active Bristol council tenants for stopping this kind of diabolical way of managing council housing. I suppose, in effect, Martin, it's a bit like a kind of housing association. The idea is to push this away from government towards a kind of halfway house between a council and a private landlord.
Yes, and of course they're allowed to borrow money and so forth, and they become semi-commercial organisations. Incidentally, in St Jude's, as an activist, I have to tell you, those people do vote. Very, very big turnout in St Jude's always. Great voters.
And also that is that was a little clip from next week's dialect, which will be on here on BCFM 93.2 at 12 noon. And that discussion is between Tom Cook, you just heard there, who's a retired bricklayer and active in tenants organisations here in Bristol, and also Labour's Cabinet Member for Homes, Paul Smith, who's discussing the various aspects of this whole Grenfell tragedy. Crime, some would say. What do you think, Eleanor?
I think there should be proper inquests into the people who died at Grenfell Tower, and I think that I'd be very surprised if there were not grounds for some criminal prosecutions coming out of them. I'm not setting myself up as judge and jury. I wouldn't presume to go ahead of that judicial process, but I think there should be proper inquests not just an inquiry that's under the control of the government.
Well, I mean, the problem here is the word. I mean, there's been a lot of campaigning for inquests, not a public inquiry. And the problem is an inquest is a legal set up designed to investigate a single death, right? So where one person's died suspiciously, say you find someone at the bottom of the stairs, they're dead. How did that happen? Was it an accident? Were they pushed? Did he fall or was he pushed, kind of thing? But a public inquiry, Martin, looks at a whole... Say something like the Titanic. That was looked at as a public inquiry. Something, or a train crash where there's multiple deaths, where you need to pool evidence from various different circumstances.
Well, as I understand it, the Metropolitan Police gave a press conference earlier today where they said they're definitely looking at criminal prosecution. So we're not talking about inquiries here. They're carrying out a criminal investigation, and they've said that it's going to be a criminal investigation. I think that's already established.
There is a problem, though, with public inquiries, and that's the Inquiries Act we mentioned briefly last week. And it was good to see the day after that the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, had written to Theresa May saying, well, if you're going to have a public inquiry, you're not going to have a government minister running it.
That's right. I mean, there's obviously a lot of suspicion about inquiries because they tend to be, you know, cover-ups, basically, especially since the Inquiries Act of 2005, which basically, you know, further limited what inquiries can and can't do. But I would suggest to you, if the police are going to carry out a criminal investigation here, that will take precedence over any inquiry, as it should.
Yeah. With Grenfell Tower also, while we're on that subject, the ministers apparently were repeatedly warned a tower block tragedy if no sprinklers were fitted. This is Mark Chandler writing in the Evening Standard. Ministers were repeatedly warned that fire regulations were not keeping people in tower blocks safe. The BBC said leaked letters show ministers were warned people living in high-rise blocks like Grenfell Tower were at risk. 12 letters sent by the all-party parliamentary fire and safety rescue group were publicised this week in a Panorama documentary on Monday, and it was all in the aftermath of a 2009 fatal fire in South London's Lackenall House. Warned the government could not afford to wait for another tragedy. The parliamentary group wrote in March 2014, surely when you already have credible evidence to justify updating the guidance, which will lead to saving of lives, you don't need to wait another 3 years. The problem was that Government Minister Liberal Democrat Stephen Williams replied, I have neither seen nor heard anything that would suggest the consideration of these specific potential changes is urgent, and I am not willing to disrupt the work of this department by asking that these matters are brought forward, Eleanor.
When you hear that now, it is absolutely heartbreaking, isn't it? To think that things could have been done so far in advance of this fire and were not.
Stephen Williams saying, my Department for Communities and Local Government's too busy to look at this. Nothing.
Well, I think if he was on this show, and he has been a frequent visitor on this show, I'm sure he would say I was wrong to say that. But it's a bit late now, isn't it?
And they got back to him saying, the group replied, we're at a loss to understand how you had concluded the credible and independent evidence which had life safety implications was not considered to be urgent.
Well, that's very, it's very unfortunate for Stephen Williams, isn't it? But at the same time, underlying all of this, and I think people are very aware of this, is the way we do business in this country simply wrong. We've been talking about bus services earlier. We're now talking about arm's length management of housing. All of this stuff is absolutely wrong. We've been going in the wrong direction for most of my lifetime. And places like Finland and Norway just think we're bonkers, and they're right.
Eleanor, there's also government ministers apparently congratulated themselves for cutting the fire regulations. This is a report in the Metro earlier this week.
This is a weird cultural phenomenon in this country that we've seemed to have all signed up to the idea that red tape is a bad thing, that regulation is a bad thing, and the more that you can get rid of it and the more you can clear it away, the better off
we'll
be.
It's called red tape, isn't it? Apparently Sahid Javid was responsible for the anti-red tape initiative. Conservative ministers were proud of slashing fire regulations just months ahead of the Grenfell Tower block blaze.
But what is red tape? What is regulation? It's rules that protect us. It's rules that keep us safe. It's rules that protect our rights as workers. It's rules that protect our safety as tenants. it's rules that protect our environment. These are the things when people talk about, oh, we're going to have a bonfire of red tape once we get out of the EU. This is what they're talking about.
The move entitled Cutting Red Tape was part of the Tory plans to abolish the health and safety culture they claimed was hurting money-making businesses.
And this is, we're back to this, profit is the only God and everything else comes secondary to that. The only thing that matters is businesses making money. How they do that, what babies have to go under the bus to make it happen, just don't matter. This is somehow something that we've signed up to as a country, and I don't feel that it was done in my name, but that's...
Well, the other important thing is the deregulation of the financial markets, which everybody with any sense realises was absolutely idiotic. So in the US, they got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated investment banking and retail banking, which had been put there for a very good reason, to prevent exactly what happened. And then, predictably enough, what happened in the 1920s happened again on a bigger scale. And we've still got Tory politicians who really do believe in deregulating financial markets. And we've still got deregulated financial markets. We haven't got control of it even now.
A Tory donor's firm owned a stake in the refurb company accused of using cheap cladding on Grenfell Tower. Collar Capital, founded by Tory donor Jeremy Collar, owned a fifth of Ryden Constructions via a partnership based offshore in Jersey.
Well, that's right. I mean, this stuff always used to be done in-house by council workers who were employed for life to manage properties. But we've got rid of all that expertise and... turned it, and you know, and this is if you can get government money flowing to private sector enterprises, then suddenly government spending isn't so bad from the point of view of the people benefiting. But in actual fact, there's a very good case that all of this stuff should be run by local government. I'm quite sure it is in places like Norway.
Also, Eleanor, Kensington Council has a £274 million reserve, and apparently it's caused outrage after the Grenfell Tower fire. Local councils are often criticised for building up significant cash reserves for borrowing money to plug day-to-day spending shortfalls, but they have been forced into difficult choices by savage cuts by central government. This is an article in The Independent. I know Bristol has also got hundreds of millions of pounds in reserves, and yet they're still cutting things here. This does seem to be almost like they're squirreling away all this cash for emergencies, but then even when an emergency happens, they're not prepared to use it.
Well, I think we do need to have some reserves which are earmarked for example, flooding, which is becoming far more likely as the seas rise and the climate warms, and for disastrous weather events. But I think there is a balance to be struck. We've been arguing in the council that we should try to avoid cuts where we can, that we should try to look at how we schedule our debt repayments in order to free up more money to cushion these really terrible changes that are all coming in at the same time. There's the cuts that we're making to our own services. At the same time, those same people are being hit by the benefits cap. We've got cuts to social care, we've got cuts to public health, all coming in at the same time. And we've been arguing as Greens that we should be using the money that we have in reserves, or we should be using the money that we're paying back on our debts, and we should reschedule those payments so that we can sort of balance out changes.
Have you done the sums? Are we going to do that?
We did the sums. We presented it as an amendment at the budget meeting, and it was voted down.
Well, you can only try. That's right, you can only try. Now, also Queen's Speech this week. I was actually quite irritated listening on the radio. They were saying, oh, the Queen's Speech was very short. Well, I thought it wasn't short. This is on 5 Live. These people are supposed to know what they're talking about. Somebody called John Pienaar, I don't quite know if he knows what he's talking about, but I looked at last year's Queen's Speech. Exactly the same length, 9.5 minutes, pretty much. So I don't know why they seemed to think it was short. I think maybe they had some.
Maybe there were some very long pauses.
Preconceived ideas. Well, she does the same kind of thing pretty much every time. So I don't know why they were saying it was short, but it wasn't. It was the same length as last year's. But Martin, what's the significance of having a Queen's speech which lasts for 2 years rather than just for one?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I think they're making it up as they go along. I understand that she wasn't dressed in the proper regalia this time, and she was wearing an EU hat, according to some of the memes on the internet. It's all getting very interesting,
anyway,
isn't it?
Oh, it's the most interesting thing, of course, about the Queen's speech is Dennis Skinner and his little intervention. Let's have a hear what he had to say this week.
Attend Her Majesty immediately in the House of Peers.
Yeah, get your skates on. First race is up, past two.
Okay, so yeah, so obviously she wanted to go to Ascot. She would much rather have had the Queen's speech on Monday, where she wouldn't have missed the Royal Ascot. But on a more serious note, there has been a lot of criticism, particularly because there's been a complete dilution in the Martin in the from them what the manifesto was when the general election has been really diluted, hasn't it, in the Queen's speech?
Well, that's good. That's because the DUP have got a largely working class voter base in Northern Ireland. They got 10 MPs, by the way. The Greens got one, even though the Greens got more votes. But the fact is that they got rid of they want to keep school meals. They don't want the dementia tax. And all of that stuff has had to be scrapped.
And so isn't it $2 billion for Northern Ireland? Is that the sticking point, do you think, why they haven't actually signed this agreement?
I think
agreement?
The real problems are going to come around. They want a soft border, as Sinn Féin do.
But that's not what the main problem, is it? The main problem is that they're making a massive demand for investment in Northern Ireland.
Yes, but that's what you'd expect them to do, saying, well, you may have austerity.
Do you think they'll get away with it?
It's perfectly legitimate for them to say, we want more money for us, but inevitably people in Bristol are going to say, well, what about more money for us? That's the way it's going to work, isn't it? But I think they're going to have real problems because the Tory right want hard Brexit and the DUP don't want hard Brexit, so I can't see this coalition lasting.
Okay, so Eleanor, what do you make of this whole Northern Ireland, the DUP, because they're now effectively running things, it seems?
Yes, I mean, the link between the Conservative Party and the DUP is not a new one. They used to work very closely together, and it was part of the Good Friday Agreement discussions that led to the DUP having to keep a little bit more distance because the government of Britain couldn't be seen to completely take sides in Northern Ireland so extremely.
Well, Sinn Féin have said this time last week or last weekend that they've broken the Good Friday Agreement. It's pretty clear. They think, legally, that the Good Friday Agreement has been torn up by the Conservatives doing this coalition deal with the DUP.
I can see how they could argue that. I really hope that we're not going to see a return to violence in Northern Ireland.
A bit of a sticky wicket Theresa May's on with this deal, isn't she, Martin?
Well, I don't think she's a bit. I doubt very much whether she's given much thought to the intricacies of Irish politics. But unfortunately, she's. You know, I mean, I think that it's going to be very unstable because don't forget the six counties actually voted to remain inside the EU. And what Sinn Féin would argue and the Irish government would argue, and that's a mandate. Then it doesn't matter whether the DUP are the largest party, they didn't win the referendum in Northern Ireland. And the EU are already saying, well, there's no reason for the six counties to leave the EU. It can remain part of the UK and part of the EU. But that, of course, means that we're going to have to negotiate on things like freedom of movement, etc.
OK, well, let's see what the Queen had to say about Brexit.
A bill will be introduced to repeal the European Communities Act and provide certainty for individuals and businesses. This will be complemented by legislation to ensure that the United Kingdom makes a success of Brexit, establishing new national policies on immigration, international sanctions, nuclear safeguards, agriculture and fisheries.
Well, I suppose quite a lot of people will be glad to see the whole fisheries thing back if it happens, although there's not that many fishermen left to be celebrating that one.
Or any fish.
Possibly, yeah. But also we've had today, Eleanor, we've had Juncker, this is Jean-Claude Juncker, saying that Britain's plan for EU citizens is simply not sufficient. He's saying that Britain's proposals to protect the rights of EU nationals after Brexit were not sufficient, while Belgium called the plan particularly vague. That's the first step, but this step is not sufficient. Trying to detail what Theresa May has been proposing, plans were to grant permanent rights to an estimated 3 million European citizens living in Britain after Brexit. It was her first offer on one of the most contentious issues of the negotiations and Britain's withdrawal from the European Union, which began on Monday this week. EU leaders have refused to debate the issue of the summit, saying it's a matter for the Brexit negotiators. That their public reaction on Friday was distinctly cool. Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel said the proposed outline of Mr May was vague. Look forward to seeing more technical details, including a judicial oversight. Now, as I understand it, they're saying that they're guaranteeing citizens' rights for something like 6 years altogether, including the 2 years of the Brexit negotiations, the Article 50 negotiations, and they're saying that after that, effectively, that that they can't guarantee people will have permanent rights to stay in Britain because they're effectively they're citizens of other countries.
I think this is really hard. I know lots of people in Bristol, because Bristol is such a mixed city. I know lots of people who are really anxious about their family's future. I know of a family whose the main breadwinner is from another European country. They're having to consider, would they be able to continue living here in this country where they've been bringing up their children, or would they have to teach those children a new language and take them off to live to the in the country of their father's origin?
I mean, I think there's a certain amount of generosity here by Theresa May. She's saying that no EU citizen living in Britain, when it leaves the EU, would have to leave, offering new permanent rights to those who arrive before a cut-off date, but without specifying where that cut-off date would fall. So effectively she's saying people are already here, can stay.
She also made the point that this would happen if there was a kind of quid pro quo from Europe for British citizens, which is kind of what she's always said. I don't think she really said anything new, although I do welcome that she took a more conciliatory tone in saying it.
Doesn't it sound quite reasonable, really, saying, well, if people who are here can stay, people who may be Brits abroad can stay, but that so that maybe the EU is saying, well, you can offer permanent rights to people who are already in Britain, but we're not going to offer permanent rights to Brits abroad.
I think that our citizenship of the EU is not something that our government can necessarily take away. I think that there are legal challenges along those lines, and I certainly have heard very positive points coming from EU leaders our EU citizenship is not something that can just be taken away from us.
Weird thing with the passport, isn't it? Because it says both British passport and EU. But anyway, Martin, one of the main problems here, sticking points again today, is that the European Union wants the European Court of Justice to do arbitration on any disputes. And of course, they're not. Well, the British government aren't going to want that. That's not really part of
Brexit. Well, no, the right
wing
press aren't going to want that, and the right wing of the Tory party.
Well, how can you have the EU?
The European Court of Justice isn't even part of the EU. It's part of other things
we've
signed up for.
One of the things we're leaving is the European Court of Justice.
You can't have
European courts deciding on British. I mean, if you're going to have Brexit.
No, if there are disputes between countries, a higher court has to make some decision. And that's the European Court of Justice, which isn't even part of the EU structure. It's part of the European structure, the OSCE.
So are you saying that Switzerland is bound by the European Court of Justice?
Yes.
And Norway is bound by the European
Court
of Justice?
Yes, they are. And of course, you can say, well, we're leaving that, but that means if a businessman, a British businessman in Portugal, gets ripped off, then he's got no recourse.
What about May's offer then, to say, well, people who are already here can stay, only if you'll say that Brits abroad can stay?
Well, I mean, it's got to be quid pro quo all the way. There's lots and lots of people.
Doesn't that sound like a reasonable offer?
Well, it's reasonable enough, but you've got to remember that the British have got lots of people who want to retire to the Costa del Sol. Now, once we've decided that we're leaving the EU, that will be the end of British people going to live on the Costa del Sol. The ones that are there already will be allowed to stay. But when we're of an age to go to the Costa del Sol, Tony, we won't be able to go. Is that what we want?
Well, that's what
if that's what we want, that's what we'll get.
That's what Brexit means.
Well, yes, in that case, there's plenty of people who still want to retire to the Costa del Sol. They're going to be disappointed, aren't they?
No, not necessarily, because you could probably retire to many countries around the world if you wish to.
There's a lot of places
that you can go to if you want to.
Yeah, of course, they could go to Saudi Arabia.
I mean, it's just
they?
That you don't have the right, that the country then would have the right to look at you and say, well, actually, do we think this person should come here or not?
Well, that's
so it's a question of open borders or not.
Well, indeed it is, but it's cuts both ways, doesn't it? Cuts both ways.
So, Ellen, do you think they're going to actually get anywhere with these talks? It sounds like they're almost hit a brick wall on the first day, on the first week.
Well, I mean, I haven't got a huge amount of faith in the team that we're sending to negotiate. I think the quality of the politicians at the top of the Conservative Party are not inspiring me to have a great deal of faith.
Well, why don't they have an election? I mean, we asked this to Mark Weston, the Tory leader, last week. You know, it just seems that it's a no-brainer. If you've got a problem with your leadership, things are not going very well, you just have an election. 120,000 members of the Conservative Party, the last person they had any role in electing was David Cameron.
Yeah, I'm not sure who would be a candidate that I would think, oh, good, they've replaced Theresa May.
Well, quite a few people saying David Davis as a potential leader, although a lot of people would probably...
He's already tried and failed.
Yeah, well, things have changed since then, haven't they? Mm. Anyway, let's move on to... have a listen now to some of the reactions to the Queen's speech. First of all, from Theresa May, I believe this one is.
Mr Speaker, we also want to build a more secure United Kingdom, investing in our defence and national security and enhancing our leading role on the world stage. Strengthening the social, economic and cultural bonds between England, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales. Delivering on our commitment to devolution by working in cooperation with all the devolved administrations. And working with all the parties in Northern Ireland to support the return of devolved government. Building a country that is stronger, fairer, safer and more secure for all our children and grandchildren. A country that works for everyone. That is our ambition and that is what this Queen's speech will help to deliver. The first part of this Queen's speech is of course about Brexit. A Brexit deal that works for every part of the country and commands the greatest possible public support. Over 80% of the electorate backed two major parties, both of whom campaigned on manifestos that said we should honour the democratic decision of the British people. So this government will respect the will of the British people and see Brexit through. We will seek to build a wide consensus as we do this and as we take bills through this House, which will include a trade bill, a repeal bill, an immigration bill, as have been referred to, and also bills to deal with control of access to our waters for fishermen and greater stability to farmers with a new bill on agriculture. I will just make a little more progress and then I will take some more interventions. But if we're going to grasp the opportunities as we leave the European Union, we need to build a stronger economy. That's right, we've always understood, as Conservatives on this side of the House, that sound money and fiscal credibility is the foundation for everything else. That's why it was right to take the tough decisions we did after the financial crash. And it has paid off. The deficit is down by three quarters. Employment is up by 2.9 million. And because of policies like the national living wage and taking 4 million of the lowest paid out of income tax altogether, inequality has been reduced to its lowest level for 30 years. So in this Queen's speech, we will continue to improve the public finances and work towards getting our country back to living within its means.
Yes, well, it's all this living within its means stuff. We've had virtually zero interest rates when you account for inflation for 8 years. On that basis, we've got a property bubble. But any attempt to increase interest rates, even by a fraction of a percent, will crash the property bubble. That's how successful this has been. We're on the brink of a property market crash. And when it crashes, the public finances will go down the drain. There was no hope whatsoever of reducing the deficit in one parliament, which is what we were promised. They don't understand economics. You can't cut the deficit while you are at the rate they want to cut it. And as pointed out earlier, if you're going to print money, you don't give it to the banks, you give it to the people.
Right, before we hear from the Green Party's Eleanor Comely, we will have a listen now to Jeremy Corbyn's riposte to what Theresa May was saying there about the Queen's speech.
Mr Speaker! This is a government without a majority, without a mandate, without a serious legislative programme, led by a Prime Minister who's lost her political authority and is struggling even today to stitch together a deal to stay in office. We will test this government's Brexit strategy and what legislation comes forward against that standard. Mr. Speaker, this election engaged more people than for a generation, a tribute to our democracy. In the election, Labour set out a vision of what this country could be. What it could be. It could be... It could be more equal. It could be more prosperous. It could have opportunities for all. That is what we on this side will be putting forward in this Parliament. What we'll be fighting for in this Parliament. What we'll be demanding in this Parliament. The people of this country deserve something better than this thin piece of very little when they have so many problems they want and demand answers to from this Parliament. We will engage fully and make that case out for a prosperous, more stable, more cohesive society in Britain. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
That's the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, there replying to this Theresa May Prime Minister's speech on the Queen's speech.
I have to say that although for us in the Green Party, having a Labour leader who actually looks like a Labour leader doesn't mean we have to work harder to make our case and to sell ourselves as a distinct and valuable part of the political landscape in this country. But although it makes it harder work for me, and that's a challenge that I'm happy to rise to, I actually quite enjoy having someone with a bit of fire on the opposition benches for a change, because for a long time it has felt like opposition was coming maybe from the SNP, largely from Caroline Lucas, but it did really feel like Labour wasn't doing much to fight back. And I think it's a really positive thing if Labour actually fills that role of opposition against a Conservative government that is still saying, as you say, tighten our belts, live within our means.
So do you think quite a lot of Greens are now doing tactical voting in a general election for Labour?
I think they always did. I think that's the story we've heard on doorsteps in Bristol West for a long time, that people say, I support the Greens, I believe in Green principles, I'll vote for you locally, but I'm just too scared that I'll let the Tories in by accident if I vote Green in the national general elections.
Also this week on Monday, we had rather a nasty little terrorist attack with a far-right van driver, white guy, driving into the crowd outside Finsbury Park Mosque. Martin, this is... I was absolutely shocked and horrified and really disgusted to see that this wasn't covered on BBC Question Time at all last night. I mean, they normally make sure they make a big meal of any kind of terror attack that happens, quite rightly. But this wasn't even mentioned on an hour of the Bullingdon Club David Dimbleby's little programme. What do you make of this attack on Monday?
Well, obviously, totally regrettable. We've got to look at whether he acted alone, because, of course, as you know, and we cover on this programme many times, there's a track record of NATO intelligence services going back 40, 50 years of actually fomenting terrorism. The Gladio networks, which carried out the Bologna bombing, the Italian police are absolutely clear that it was NATO intelligence services, the so-called strategy of tension.
Well, that was even the intelligence services killing police officers, wasn't
That's right, and it's all on the record. The head of the Italian Supreme Court, Imposimato, has written a book about all of this, written in Italian, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, the Republic of the Unpunished Massacres. Those who know, those who listen to this programme will understand we're always suspicious that there's more to something
going on.
Now, I mean,
we've heard lots and lots about people like Abu Hamza, Abu Qatada, these hate preachers, people like Anjam Chowdhury. What about the role...
All of whom were MI5 agents, by the way.
What about the role of Tommy Robinson? We're going to hear now... not often we hear Tommy Robinson on this programme, but here's some of the things he was saying after the London Bridge attack, where he was actually called.
He just happened to be there, didn't he?
No. The Westminster Bridge attack, he happened to be up. But on the evening of the London Bridge attack, he put out this call for militias, effectively, to take on the Muslim problem. So, potentially, I mean, you could even think of him as a hate preacher. Let's have a listen to what Mr. Tommy Robinson, the former leader of the English Defence League, the EDL, who, of course, met in the very early days before they'd come to the public view with Anders Behring Breivik, who massacred all those people over in Norway. He actually flew to Britain to meet the EDL leaders before he massacred all these young socialists over in Norway. So let's have a listen to what Tommy Robinson had to say. Maybe we can consider whether he sounds like a hate preacher.
At around 10:30 this evening, a van drove into pedestrians on London Bridge in another Islamic attack. This coming off the back of the Manchester suicide bombings, which only happened 2 weeks ago. Stabbings and gunfire have already been reported at the scenes. How many more of these atrocities are we to put up with? Why is our government and our security services allowing more than 3,500 known jihadi scumbags to roam our streets while the UK taxpayer forks the bill for these disgusting, depraved, death-loving Muslims? The UK government needs to bring back internment, lock up these suspected 3,500 terrorists and prevent more murder and mayhem on our streets. In fact, internment should be expanded to more than just the suspected terrorists. It should also include all those who support and encourage them. The UK government security services will be hard pressed to deal with all 3,500 suspected terrorists in this country and their supporters, so the UK government should mobilise the army. Perhaps politicians who live a very comfortable life far away from the areas infested with the religion of peace should give some serious consideration into resigning, as they're failing the UK in a spectacular fashion.
There.
If we get this issue dealt with, then the British public will. They will end up taking matters into their own hands. Take Northern Ireland as a prime example. Militias will be set up, and then the UK government will have a problem beyond their wildest dreams. Inaction will only facilitate the creation of a disgruntled and angry population who will end up cleaning out this Islamic problem. Britain, wake up and wake up fast.
Anyway, the voice of Tommy Robinson, former leader of the EDL, who supposedly gave up his racism. Martin, he's talking there about, and apologies for the swearing, managed to miss that as I edited it, 3,500 apparently jihadis around, and he's calling for internment.
Well, it's interesting because we've got the most jihadi population in the world. You know why that is? Because MI6 encouraged people to come here from all over the world in the 1980s and under Operation Cyclone. And of course, and the bomber in Manchester, his family were part of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group.
Okay, so
and they're allowed to come
agreeing,
in and out by the security
with,
services.
Now, Martin, are you agreeing with Tommy Robinson then?
No, I'm pointing out that Tommy's missing the point. These people are allowed to come in and out because they're working with the security services. In actual fact, all of the Islamic extremists all over the world, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, they're all cooperating with MI6, CIA, and they have been for the last 30 years. Tommy sounds like somebody from the loyalist paramilitaries, and he's going to set up a loyalist paramilitary, is he?
But
well, in actual fact, the loyalist paramilitaries were being run by the British Army for 30 years. That was on the Panorama programme by Donald McIntyre last year.
He's also talking
Tommy's
about
a bit of an ignoramus.
He's talking about mobilising the army too.
Well, if we're going to have internment, we'll have to carry out internment. Maybe Tommy would be one of these first people that would have to be interned if we're going to have internment. And, of course, it didn't work in Northern Ireland. The internment of people in Northern Ireland intensified the conflict. But, of course, he's still missing the point. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, I've got an intimate relationship with MI6 going back to the 1980s.
Well, okay, what about the comparison
that's why they
between,
come and go.
Between people like Anjem Chowdhury and Robinson? I mean, what's the difference
well,
in terms of
fact,
encouraging
what we suspect
terrorism?
Is all of the Anjem Chowdhury, Abu Hamza, Haroon Aswat, who was named by the Metropolitan Police as the mastermind of the 7/7 bombings, all of them British agents.
I mean,
all of them.
He's encouraging, he's talking about being infested by Muslims. He doesn't also make any real distinction between Muslims and, should we say, jihadis or Islamists.
No, I would suspect that Tommy is also part of a strategy of tension. That's what they did in Italy. The far right, the far left, all being manipulated by seasoned.
So should he be arrested under the same laws as people like Chowdhury
well,
were?
Well, I don't think people should be arrested for freedom, for speaking their minds, but if we're going to arrest people for speaking their minds, he's got to be top of the list, hasn't he?
Anyway, Eleanor, pretty highly charged this. Also, lots of swearing through that. I apologise again for that. And I will put a link up to that interview with Robinson, but do be aware there's lots of swearing in it. A lot of it is really racist language. What do you make of him? Should he be treated in the same way as these Islamic so-called hate preachers?
I don't think there's much to choose between the two. I think that both are trying to... I don't know anything about the conspiracies that you outlined there, so I can't speak to that. But it's people doing what they have to do to increase their own power, that his power comes from this idea that there is an Islamic threat and that white men must stand up and fight against them. That's where he gets his power and influence from. So, of course, he's going to sell that story. And the same is true of someone in ISIS who is trying to stir up tensions, stir up hatred, because that's where they derive their power from. I think the answer for us is to hold the centre together and to not allow hatred and tensions to be inflamed in us and in our communities.
Well, it's time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guests. That's Green Councillor for Bishopston and Ashley Down, Eleanor Combley. Would you like to pronounce it properly?
Combley.
Combley. Okay, thanks very much.
You've been getting closer and closer.
After the Murdoch News, the Freemasons.
Bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.